Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Ellen Brown. Ellen, great having you on for one more show.
Thank you.
Hi, Robert. This is Charles Lincoln calling in from New Orleans.
Yes, my guest co-host is joining us again, as he joined us on our last show with Ellen. So we're going to be discussing the topic of the crisis in Greece and the economic crisis there. And Ellen, you've written a number of different articles about Greece. How long have you been following the situation in Greece in your writings?
Well, I think I started writing about it in 2010 when the Greek debt suddenly shot up, and it was because that George Soros and other speculators had gathered, I guess, or Soros people had gathered in New York, and they collectively planned that they would trash the Greek debt, and that forced their interest rates up, and of course that drove their debt quite a bit higher. And then the more vulnerable they look, the more people don't want to buy their debt, and the more shaky the whole thing is. But of course the first thing that went wrong was that Goldman Sachs stepped in 2001 and used derivatives and to make the debt look not as large as it was in order to get Greece into the Eurozone. But the result of that was to actually double the debt by 2006. And then in 2010, when the Troika wanted to get them into austerity mode, get them to take a bailout, which would come with strings attached, mainly that they would have to sell off their privatize their choice public assets, lay people off, you know, cut back on services, etc. But in order to do that, into that bailout, they had to show that they were heavily in debt. And so there's some evidence that they actually made the debt look worse than it was. At that time, they had a Goldman Sachs Eurocrat in charge who made the debt look worse than he was. Or maybe it was, I'm sorry, I've forgotten, it may have been the prime minister, but it definitely wasn't this prime minister. It was, one sympathetic to the creditors. So they've actually been toyed with all along, and their debt has been made to look worse than it was and has been made worse than it needed to be in order to, I think they're like Cyprus, that they're sort of scapegoats or test cases to see if the smaller countries can be driven into basically the status of a third world, vassal of the Eurozone, particularly the Germans. But I don't think it's really the German people either. It's the creditors who are working through the larger countries. And the creditors Goldman Sachs and other big banks.
Basically, what the media is saying is, from the German perspective, they're saying that the Greeks are just lazy and mooching off Germany. And then from the Greek perspective, the media is saying that the Germans are just control freaks and they want to control Greece. So they play, which they don't really talk about the role of the bankers. Charles, you also have a personal connection to Greece.
I have lots of personal connections to Greece, actually, and I'm very familiar with sort of the story that's going around in Greece. Is that basically they feel that this is illegal, that the entire agreement is illegal, and I want Ellen's perspective on that. The Greek Parliament assembled this Truth Commission on the Public Debt, and I've been reading through that and been corresponding with a friend of mine who's a banker in London, Holger Schmid. And Holger is of the opinion that the whole thing has been very, very politicized, and what Ellen is saying is very interesting about them trying to, in essence, colonize colonize the southeast portion of Europe. But what, Ellen, what is your perspective on the social issues involved? I mean, the debate in this question of legality focuses on the question of human rights to certain, well, I guess what in the U.S. lingo we'd call entitlements, basically welfare and pension entitlements. The banks have been closed now for about a month, and people aren't getting their pensions. I don't know, is there ever a case where that you know of where banks have closed for almost a month in any country?
Well, it does mirror what happened in the Depression. I mean, they're not quite closed. They're letting a little trickle of cash out. But that is the fault of the ECB, the central bank, which should be providing liquidity. That's the function of a central bank, and that's what I've written about quite a bit. In the U.S., when the banks collapsed, the Federal Reserve stepped up to the tune of $16 trillion or more. I've read figures as high as $24 trillion. And what they did was...
You're talking about 2008, 2009.
Right, and for a couple of years after that, where they were basically... I mean, they're not putting up real money. They're putting up quantitative easing money or just credit on the books. In other words, they're just allowing these, they're backstopping these loans, and that's what a central bank should do. And if you don't have a central bank doing that, your banking system will fail because of the nature of banking. All banks lend money they don't have. They all lend, the depositors think their money is in the bank, and yet that money has all been lent out to borrowers. So really the money that they lend to borrowers, as the Bank of England just recently acknowledged, is money that's just created on the book. It's books, it's fake money, but it's money that works in the system. I mean, it's money that's out there, and that's where our money supply comes from banks creating credit on their books. So the only way that can work is that in a closed system, it will work, because you create some money, it becomes a check which goes into another bank, and then you can borrow it back from that other bank, which now has excess reserves, and you have insufficient reserves. So in order to make the books balance, in order to clear your check through, in the U.S., it would be through the Federal Reserve or some other clearinghouse, you can borrow that money back very cheaply at the Fed funds rate of 0.25%, and you've actually made the loan at 4 or 5 or 8 or 16, depending on what kind of loan it is. So you get a nice spread out of that, out of money that you created out of nothing. But where you run into problems is where there's leakage. If people pull money out of the banks and put it in under the mattress, or they put it in the stock market, or they buy other things with it, or the money goes abroad, then you're not going to have the cash in the system for people who want to make, you know, even modest withdrawals. And when you have a run on the banks, as they do in Greece, when you've purposely created a situation where people don't trust the banks, you're going to have runs where they're going to purposely take their money out, and that will collapse the banks. And that's what's happened here. And in that situation, as happened in 2008 in the U.S., the central bank is supposed to step up and save the day. What happened in the 1930s was there was a bank holiday briefly, and when the banks opened up again, Roosevelt said, new deal, you know, new game. We're not going to play with gold anymore. Now we're not going to be on the gold standard. We're just going to create the money on our books. So they can do that. They can fix it, because all money is created on the books in the first place. It's all just accounting entries, and they can fix the accounting entries if they have the will. But obviously the political will here was the other way. And we saw that starting in December, when there was the threat that the Greek parliament would not elect the pro-austerity prime minister, and that Tsipras was looking like they were going to win. Just with that threat, Goldman Sachs came out with a memo that said basically, don't try it, because if things are looking delicate or whatever, if you have trouble with the creditors, then your liquidity might be cut off from the central bank. Well, there's no reason that the central bank should cut off liquidity just because there's some issue with the creditors. But in February, right after the Syriza party was elected, immediately the central bank cut off credit, or they cut off the ordinary liquidity, and they went to this emergency form of liquidity, which they could turn on and off at will, and which was more expensive for the Greek banks. So just the fact that they did that made everybody doubt the banks and start, you know, you had this slow trickle of, it was a slow run starting all the way from February. People kept pulling their money out of the Greek banks. And it got worse and worse, more of a flood. It got more delicate.
Do you have a perspective on this question of legality, though, about whether the, are there, you're an attorney, and are there legal problems, in your view, with the deals that have been cut? Because, again, there's this Truth Commission on Public Debt that the Greek Parliament set up, and they concluded that the debt was illegal and that it violated human rights of the people of Greece. And that's sort of an alien concept in America, I think, that that banking would be directly connected to human rights. What do you think about that position?
Legal,
and the politics
legal under what law? International law or Greek law?
International and Greek law. Again, this is a commission that was assembled in April, which would be like halfway between Prime Minister Tsipras Syriza party taking power and the referendum. And the problem that's happened, of course, is that Tsipras called this referendum for like the 4th of July weekend, basically, and the Greek people voted no. And then as my friend Holger had predicted, they immediately turned around in Parliament and voted for it and to adopt it, basically with no changes. And so there's this puppet theater appearance of the Tsipras government. Some people are calling him a traitor. Some people are saying that he took a payoff. There's a great tradition of corruption in Greece, which almost matches the reputation of Louisiana and Chicago.
Is the Greek president, is he up down Syriza party? The Socialist Party.
Prime Minister, the Prime Minister. It's the Syriza is, it's a coalition. It's largely it consists of largely the now defunct PASOK party. The PASOK was the Socialist Party that was in control for a very long time. They were notoriously corrupt, and they are the majority of the members of Syriza, but Syriza is basically a coalition. It's a coalition government that they put together, and it's not really a very coherent. It's portrayed by Angela Merkel and others as a hard left party, but the perception in Greece certainly is that it's not even remotely, because it was the Communist Party. Allied, oddly enough, with the Golden Dawn, the fascist party. The communists and the fascists were the one who took an alliance and totally wanted to reject every kind of deal with the European Community. And Syriza was basically in the role of trying to play the middle. And
because Syriza, I know, is very hostile towards Golden Dawn.
Well, the whole idea is that they're kind of acting as agents for the European Community in some sense. Tsipras takes this he's anti bailout position, and then his party and they submit it to the people. The people reject it by a 2-1 margin. 66% of the Greek people voted no, and then the next week Parliament ratifies it. I mean, this is... I really am curious about Ellen's perspective on this. Is this in any sense a legal problem for the European community, that they are disregarding political will and what in Greece is perceived as the contract between the people and the government with regard to human rights? They considered welfare basically to be an issue of human rights, pensions. A lot of people I know are in fact pensioners in Greece. It's not just for older people; it's for younger people. And you know, they took the steps of converting the property from converting the Greek economy. Back when I was married there 25 years ago, it was almost entirely still a cash economy, and in those 25 years since, it's been converted into a credit economy, and that's been it's created a lot of difficulties and a lot of weakness as people, you know, try to adjust, and they the only way they can have a reliable source of cash is frequently through government pensions, because the combined GNP of Greece is limited really to fishing and tourism and a very small amount of agriculture, which was sufficient for self-sustaining but not really sufficient for agribusiness. But mm-hmm. on this issue of legality of the of human rights, as I said, the word in the U.S. law is entitlement. What do you think about that, Ellen?
Well, I think it is illegal, or definitely large portions of it were illegal. But I would, if I were arguing it, I wouldn't try to argue human rights. I would argue actual odious debt. In other words, it was debts incurred under false pretenses and by people who didn't really represent the people, by bureaucrats, you know, bureaucrats who were representing the creditors, basically.
Now, that phrase, odious debt, is actually a term of art in the international debt community. Could you explain that, your understanding of that term, to us? Because thought it specifically did refer to human rights.
Odious debt refers to debt that was not properly incurred. In other words, it was incurred, maybe it's used, for example, if you have a dictator that the people didn't elect and didn't approve of, who was doing things that were, you know, extra outside their jurisdiction, or contracts that where you didn't understand the terms, or what, you know, that were fraudulently induced, that kind of stuff. It's just debt that the people did not properly legally agree to be bound by. But of course, that applies to every sort of debt of governments, because the people really don't do anything except vote every few years for a couple of people, and that's it.
The referendum, the people did say no, and then Parliament then immediately adopted it. What do you think of that, Ellen?
I read that the referendum was not actually legally binding, but even so, it seems to me. I mean, I tend to think that Tsipras had no choice. That he thought that he would be able to get some better terms, and he realized they just weren't. You know, it was my way or the highway. And at one point, they thought they were negotiating with Russia, and then Russia said no, that they wouldn't do it. And so they really had no choice. I mean, they had people who were starving, you know, people who don't have food, and you have a banking system that is, the banks are closing. People can't get their money, so they can't buy food. And so you've got to feed the people first. And then I'm hoping that they're just buying time, and that at some point they'll just throw it all off and go back to the drachma. But, or I actually have a solution for how they could stay within the Eurozone and use the Euro and still expand their money supply. Now that we know that all money is created by banks when they create loans, they can nationalize the banks, which they should do anyway because the banks are insolvent. And then,
would the European Union, does a regulation allow for an independent country to nationalize its banks?
Oh no, they would be withdrawing from the European community if that they did that.
So they would have to withdraw first to do that.
No, they wouldn't have to, but they'd be out of it immediately if they did. I mean, I don't see how that could be consistent with what the euro is all about. Do you, Ellen?
Well, but if the banks are bankrupt, that's what you're. I mean, even in the U.S., it used to be before 2008. That was the rule. If you had a large bankrupt bank, if it was a small bank, you just shut it down, sold off the assets, the creditors stood in line and got paid according to whatever was there. But if it was a big bank, you were supposed to nationalize it, and that's what they did with Continental Illinois, which was at the time it was the fourth largest bank in the country, and it went bankrupt, and they nationalized it. And this is in a capitalist country. I mean, that's what are you going to do when you have a bank that is bankrupt? You've got to take it over for a while and sort it out. If you can't just shut it down because it's too big and it's too involved in, it's got its fingers everywhere, then you've got to take it over, which means nationalizing it. So I don't know that that's a violation. I mean, I saw this proposed that they could do this, nationalize the banks, then start issuing loans, which is how you make money, create money. So you would issue loans to all the businesses and to the government if they're allowed to do that, and this will get the money flowing again. China does that all the time. You know, they have a managed banking system because they own the banks, so they tell the banks. They don't let the banks just decide, oh, no, we'd rather play with the derivatives than make loans to small business. They say, no, you're going to make loans to small business, and that's what they do. And it works very well for them, and Japan does the same thing. But right now they have a managed economy in that now the creditors have said, we're going to make all the decisions. We're going to tell you exactly what you're going to do with your economy. So it's an economy managed by the borrower is servant to the lender, so they're servants of the creditors, and the creditors are calling the shots. I mean, normally, if you owe money to a bank, they don't tell you how to run your business. They just say, you know, pay up or go bankrupt or whatever. You know, you can default and still survive. They don't meddle in everything, but that's what they're doing in these governments. And I think that was that's sort of a pilot to see if they can get away with it.
What would your scenario be for Greece to go back to the drachma, or Austria to go back to the mark, or the shilling, or Germany to go back to the mark? Any of these countries? How do you do that? How do you go step by step through withdrawing from one economic monetary system and going to another? How would that happen?
Well, I think that's one reason they didn't do it, is it's not that simple. If it were Argentina did it, went back to the peso, but the difference was Argentina was already using the peso, but it was pegged to the dollar. So then when all they did was unpeg it, but they already had their whole banking system was set up, denominated in pesos. Everybody knew how much money they had. I mean, the peso got devalued, but at least the numbers all worked. You know, the banking system still worked. But here, you've got to recalibrate everything, turn everything into a new currency. And then you have to print the currency, so it is said. Although it seems to me what they could do is to peg it one-to-one to the euro and peg it. Don't let it change. That's what they did in Malaysia. So you have strict capital controls. It's basically when you come to Greece, you leave your euros at the door and you trade them in for drachmas. And when you go out, you trade your drachmas back. So you're not allowed to take them out of the country. And therefore, you can...
England had something like that in the 1960s. And it was very interesting because an American who wanted to live in England basically had to set up their own English credit and there were various means of exchanging letters of credit between banks. I know that because my parents were living in England and at that time, and they went through hell, getting Dallas banks to prove to English banks that they should be given credit since they couldn't actually bring any money with them.
Yeah, that's well, it would definitely be tricky, but it could be done. But I can see why it takes time and they couldn't just jump right into it. Plus, they have the problem that even though the people do not want to accept this credit deal, they don't want to leave the euro either. And that's what Tsipras said. He said, I don't have the public mandate to leave the euro.
How effective was it when Iceland defaulted on their debt?
Well, the difference, it was very effective, and that is a model they could follow. But Iceland, too, suffered a bit, of course. Every country does when they do something like that. But the difference was that, first of all, Iceland was not in the EU, so they weren't bound by the EU rules. They were already using their own currency. So, again, it was just a matter of defaulting on the debt, which was not all that complicated. I mean, it was drastic, but it wasn't complicated. It's just, you just say, I'm not going to pay. It's not like you have to change your whole system over in some way.
You mentioned how the role that George Soros played in all this earlier. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on a lot of the funding that a lot of different kind of phony left-wing movements get from George Soros, and what role that he plays in funding various political causes?
Well, I only know what I read, of course, but there is, you do read that all these color revolutions are funded by someone, whether it's George Soros, or, I don't know. I know somebody who got sued for saying that, so I would hesitate to to be too sure of myself when I haven't really, I don't have hard data on it. But anyway, it does look to me, I mean, definitely the color revolutions are funded by somebody over here. I mean, I would suspect our government, maybe the CIA is funding them. I don't know. They want regime change. They want they don't want Tsipras in, for sure. They want the conservative party that's willing to go along with the program. Our government wants the EU to hold together because of NATO. They want NATO to hold together because that's their excuse for being there in Europe in the first place, surrounding Russia and surrounding China, et cetera. And they need all those countries. They don't want Greece going off and joining Russia in a bunch of deals and not being part of NATO. That's an important base for them. So who knows what Washington...
Two questions. One, why would you think that the Greek people would not want to leave the Eurozone at this point? What advantages is it giving them in your perspective right now? I mean, the people I know are against it, are against staying in the EC, but, and maybe Tsipras is lying, and I mean, everyone did vote no on this. So what would be the advantages that you see what are the advantages to staying in the Eurozone at this point?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I've wondered too, but I heard Robert Scheer on a talk show make a good argument. He said that it's a cultural thing, that we, the Americans, are the people who left Europe. So we're the rebels. We believe in capitalism and sovereignty and individualities and striking out on our own and not, being under anyone's thumb. But Europe is really into solidarity. They firmly believe in sticking together. They are socialists. They may not call themselves socialists, but even Germany is far more socialist than we are. And as Robert Scheer said, they would not even consider going back to being so, having so few social services as we have here, like the fact that we leave our homeless on the streets and... there are many, our social services are not that good, and we're even consider things like our railroads are so poor compared to the service you can get in Europe.
Oh, God, yes. You can go any place on a railroad in Europe. But That gets back then, I guess, to the issue of human rights, and that in part of this debate is that human rights to public benefits, or basically to support. You said you didn't like that argument.
I certainly like it in terms of I believe in human rights. I'm just saying that I could see where a court could overlook that argument. I mean, it seems to me your stronger argument is blatant breach of contract. But then I don't know. Are there provisions in the Maastricht Treaty that say that, you know, does it come out and say a lot about human rights and what people are entitled to?
They have socioeconomic rights in Europe that are not provided in the U.S. Constitution. Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult question of exactly how to construe them, but there is a right to medical care and to food and to a home that has never been provided in the U.S. But ironically, one of the biggest crises, part of the crisis in Greece right now, is that because of credit, residents. Ownership of real property has become much more unstable than it ever was before, and so the people I know, they are talking about how there is the fear that this system is being used basically to abolish private property completely, so that no one has security of home. People who lived in houses basically ever since historical records go back basically into the 18th and 17th and 18th century, when it was still part of the Ottoman Empire. And some families who have their records showing that they've been in possession of the same house, same piece of farmland since, the late 17th century, they are being forced out of their home because certain groups are simply, extending credit involuntarily, almost imposing certain taxes to support the system, and that's what's causing huge dislocations. So first they get people to want cash and to accept credit. And then they're basically taking it away by the process of foreclosure, which of course is very, very closely analogous to what's happening in the U.S.
Their homes up as security.
Yeah, exactly. And then they lose everything very quickly. Yeah, exactly.
So with the foreclosure thing, they do that on an individual basis, to, like a person's home. But they do it to whole countries on a larger basis with asset seizure. So let's say they get a small country into debt, and the country can't pay its debts. So what they do is they take over all the natural resources. They take over the water rights, the oil rights, the mining rights.
Well, I mean, I don't know about that exactly, because it depends on whether they're nationally owned or not. Otherwise, what they do is they buy them from the private interests. Who are heavily leveraged. I mean, for example, Hollywood stars right now, Johnny Depp, a couple of other people are recently buying Greek islands at fire sale prices. So it's the idea that basically liquid capital chases heavily leveraged capital, this is part of the instability and part of the indeed the question of sovereignty that Ellen mentioned is something that again ironically both the communists and the Golden Dawn are raising together, that Greece is completely losing its sovereignty because of this heavily leveraged situation. And it's just interesting that this concept of human rights guarantees depends on basically the credit economy, and yet at the same time it's undermining and destroying the traditional stability of home ownership and family economy, which was based on almost true inalienable land ownership.
You know, it was interesting what you said about that they used to be a cash economy, too, and now that they've gone to banking. I heard, I saw that the banks are trying to attract people's money back. You know, everybody's pulled the cash out and put it under their mattresses, which is why the banks have this big problem. So they're saying, you know, it's idiotic to put your money back in the bank. And the people are just laughing, and they're saying, no way will you ever get my money again. They don't trust their banks
anymore. But, of course, people who are dependent on pensions, I mean, they have not been receiving their pension checks because the banks are only authorized to allow withdrawals of 50 euros per day. And, you know, that you have to be right there in Greece in a bank to get it. And so people, for example, who are living abroad, they don't get their pensions checks at all.
As far as pensions go, what is more common, bankers looting private or public pensions?
The ones that I'm familiar with are all public. So they go through the banking system. So what difference does it make? I mean, I don't think that if a bank is closed, it can't distribute either a private or a private corporate or a public pension. I mean, unless the corporation has its own independent bank, basically, if it won't be able to distribute money to anybody except through the use of the government banks. And you know, they talk about private banks in Europe. My friend Holger Schmieding works for one, but you know, they don't actually have such a thing as private banks, and that these private banks, unlike you know, pre-Civil War days in the United States, no bank in Europe actually issues its own money. No bank in Europe or the United States, or really hardly anywhere that I'm aware of, issues its own money, and so there's really no. Do you think there's such a thing as a genuinely private bank, Ellen?
Well, how do you mean?
They issue credit on their books, but
they're using the full faith and credit of the U.S. I mean, if they didn't have a charter, they wouldn't be able to get away with it. So.
Right, but I mean, but no bank actually issues its own currency.
Oh, so right, of course. Yeah, they're issuing.
It's all one single monetary system.
But they are private. They're privately owned and privately controlled. They've just managed to usurp the public money supply by pretending that what they've done is to take in deposits and then lend them out again, but that's not what they're doing. They take in deposits and then they create deposits. They create more deposits on their books, and the reason they can get away with that is because they are depository institutions. Nobody can tell the difference between fake deposits that have been created on the books and ones that have come in from outside.
And in essence, the monetary standardization of the centralized banks permits that, because in a central banking system, the expression in America is all money is green, or in England, all money has a picture of the Queen.
And we're talking about digital money, though. Nearly all of our money supply is digital.
Sure. What would we? Ellen, I've got to ask you this. What's the option of the alternative to digital money? What would you call that?
Well, actually, I'm not opposed to digital money. For Greece, I think that's what they should do. They could go all digital, and that would solve the problem because they'd know where all the money was. They could get, I mean, it's, if it were a public banking system, I think they could go all digital. You don't want an all digital private banking system because then you're going to have all those hazards that everybody's really worried about, the ways of doing haircuts and taking our money and so forth.
So economist Jeffrey Sachs, you have a quote by him from the Financial Times in 2012, and he said basically one of the main reasons there was this economic collapse in Greece is that the banks made it impossible for smaller, medium-sized enterprises to attain loans to either to continue their business or to start up a business.
Right. Yeah, so that's the problem. You've got to get money into the system, and you've got to get it to the small and medium-sized businesses, which are the people who create jobs. And we have the same problem in the U.S., and they certainly had the same problem in the Great Depression. I mean, you heard stories of the fruit was falling off the trees, but it didn't. But people were starving because they didn't have the money to pay the workers, and they didn't have the money. Nobody had the money to buy the fruit once it got to market. So that's just a failure of what should be public infrastructure. I would see banking as infrastructure, just like water and power and railroads. It's something that connects people, it connects trade. And if you don't have the liquidity, just like in your water system, so that you've got money sloshing around that you can trade, you know, you can move from one party to another, then the system shuts down. So that really should be the responsibility of the government, and I think the banking system should be a public utility, operated by the people for the benefit of the people. I know everybody's afraid of government, and I am too. I mean, you can't trust our current governments, but let's assume that we got back the power to create money, that it went back to some public banks. They could actually fund government wouldn't have to be, politicians wouldn't have to be begging, going to the hat in hand to the bank. They would have their own source of funding, and so they could do the right thing. And we saw that, for example, with every once in a while you get a green mayor who gets elected, and the mayor of Richmond, California,
the Bay Area.
Is a green, and greens don't take corporate money, so she was not beholden to the big corporation, Gail McLaughlin. So what she did was she stood up to Chevron, which is the company that runs Richmond, and she got a big settlement. And then she stood up to the big banks, and it is doing this eminent domain. They haven't actually pulled it off, but she's pushing for it. She keeps pushing hard. And she had a number of, I think she had 4 terms as mayor, and now she's on the city council. So that's what you can do if you're not beholden to big banks. I mean, I think most politicians, most people go into government because they actually do want to do something good. I know a lot of politicians are corrupt, but you would have a lot more responsible politicians if they didn't have to spend all their time kissing up to big banks and big money.
Are any of the candidates running for president right now talking about serious financial reform?
Not to my knowledge. Have you noticed any? I mean, of course,
no,
not
really.
I was about to break out in laughter at the very thought of it.
Yeah. Ron Paul did, you know, and Dennis Kucinich, and they both got laughed out. Well, Dennis Kucinich got laughed out, and Ron Paul got, I guess he sort of got laughed out, too. If they can't get you on some scandal, then they make you look ridiculous in some way.
His son, Rand Paul, is not really talking about the same issues. He's just talking about lower taxes, but he's not talking about the same issues like the Federal Reserve as much.
No, he's definitely not. He's I managed to get on all his mailing lists, and he's basically a spam artist who's pushing social issues at the expense of, you know, economic soundness. I don't have a lot of regard for Rand Paul. I don't know if I'm stepping on anybody's toes here, but I think he's a bit of a fraud, playing on his father's name.
Well, my feeling is that you can't do much at the federal level. So what we have to aim for is the state level, or even smaller, the city level, to start, just to show it can be done. And for me, I'm just trying to get information out there.
you were saying that Gail stood up to Chevron. What exactly did she do? Because I don't know the story.
Well, she sued him for back taxes, and she won. They've taken over the city, and they pollute it horribly. She sued him and won, but it was for back taxes, unpaid taxes. So she got a big settlement out of them.
I don't know. Just
I don't know what
Greece.
She's been about.
To get back to Greece for a minute or two, what do you think the solution is between the desire of the people everywhere for social welfare and for guarantees of social welfare and the preservation of stability through private property and private ownership? How do you feel about that? Do you think that's a genuine conflict, or is it just the way the system is set up, or what's your perspective on that? Because that's one of the most profound things that I've seen, not just in Greece, but actually in Lithuania and all over Europe, really. That and when communism collapsed, everybody took private property, and they thought it was private, in the same way that Greece sort of had this very ancient tradition of private property. But once you get into a cash economy, a credit economy rather, you know, you're in the position of you have to borrow to survive, basically, and it seems to erode and intrude on the ability to maintain private ownership in a very profound way. How do you feel about that contradiction?
Well, 50%. On average, of all governments, are public, and you know, public sector, and 50% are private sector. So it's just what you put in the public sector and the private sector. I think, of course, people should have their own private property, but you need public services. And what the Japanese discovered was that you don't need to manage everything. You know, you don't have to turn all your big industries into public enterprises. All you have to do is manage the banks, because the bank, that's the control point, where that's how you feed money into the system. So if you can determine where the money's going to go, then the government can control, you know, they can plan the economy. I mean, it's a planned economy, but in a good sense, that they can take the long view and do whatever is good for the economy. But meanwhile, you can allow people to have their private property, their private companies. In fact, the way they do their private companies in Japan is they're called keiretsu, which are sort of like cooperatives. So it's a bunch of companies that are all, I mean, you could call it a cartel, but they're all working together. So you'd have a bank in your keiretsu, and you'd have all these other companies, and the bank would service the other companies. So you've got your own bank that can create credit the way all banks do, and you own it, you the collective group of companies, but it's still private. You're still a private collection of companies, but you're working together in a cooperative way. So I think we can see that it works more efficiently than what we're going through now.
Something like that operating in San Francisco. Do you know anything about that in the Chinese in the Chinese community of San Francisco? Cooperatives
No.
like that?
No, I don't.
Yeah. A friend of mine who used to work for Bank of America, he said that there are sort of mutual assistance societies like that in the Chinese community in San Francisco that sounded very, very interesting. He didn't specifically compare them to the Koretsu, but very much like what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's this sort of dichotomy in politics, especially in American politics. A lot of people think that if you have social programs, it means that people have to give up their private property, their property rights, and have high taxes. But you would make the argument that if there was a public bank, then you could have a society where people had private property and a fair tax rate, and at the same time had social programs of public banking. Could you address both those concerns?
Yeah, totally. Well, look at North Dakota, that's our one and only model, and they're certainly into private property. I mean, they're a totally red state. They're very conservative, but they have a publicly owned bank, which works. It's for them, it's not socialism. It's state sovereignty. It's like, we want to keep our money in our state, and we're going to use that to service our... What the Bank of North Dakota does is it works with the local banks, which are private. So it partners with the community banks, expands their ability to create credit for the community, and uses the state's revenues as their funding, their liquidity source. So they're using their own revenues to create credit for their own community. So it's very private oriented, but it's sort of a cooperative private thing.
Is there any tension in North Dakota between the state banking system and the national banking system?
Sorry, say that again.
Is there tension or conflict of any kind between the state banking system of North Dakota and the national bank, Federal Reserve banking system?
Well, the Bank of North Dakota has Federal Reserve privileges. I mean, every bank needs a central bank to backstop it. It's not, they don't have the power to create their own money except in the way that all banks do, which is by creating it as loans. So no, and they're very low key. They stay under the radar, so they don't make a big deal about, look at us, we're the only state in the country. I mean, I make a big deal about it, which I don't think they're particularly pleased about, because they liked being low-key and looking like they were conservative while they're using this tool that nobody else has.
I don't know. What do you think about this possibility, though, of going back to a system, what I was calling a true private bank, such as we had in the U.S. prior to the Civil War, where banks issue their own currency and circulate them?
I think it wouldn't work. I mean, what they did were they were issuing their own bank notes, which were supposedly promissory notes for gold, and there's no way we're going back to a gold system. And on average, there was a banking crisis every 6 years during the 19th century. So it was not a stable system, and they kept changing it. I wrote a piece that I haven't ever posted, but every 20 years, on average, we've totally changed our banking system because it wasn't stable. So.
Well, but I mean, we have instead sort of a constant, ongoing crisis right now. It's just a matter of the frequency of foreclosures, the frequency of the bankruptcy courts are sort of crowded wall to wall everywhere in the United States, and the number of foreclosures is sort of hovering right between 5% and 10% at all every place I'm aware of, and how is that really superior, do you think?
Well, I just don't think that. I mean, how would you go? Are you going to have the banks have gold? What are they going to back their private
bank? The great objection to gold, of course, is that there's not enough of it to go around. And so the answer to that would be that I guess you'd have to have a multi-substance-backed economy. That banks would specialize in different industries, I guess, and whatever was being produced in one industry would be the subject of a particular bank's currency. I guess as from a historical and anthropological perspective, banks basically evolved out of warehouses and storage systems. As you said, the concept of banks as depository institutions, and so going back to ancient times, I mean, they had common storehouses in Mesopotamia for wheat and wheat and cattle and oats and in terms of the agricultural manufacturing world, you can sort of imagine that it's a little bit more difficult to imagine for, I don't know, people who make their money primarily through television or radio or blogs or something, how you'd, but you could have specialized banks that basically are connected to the productivity of certain products or services.
Well, basically what you're talking about is multiple community currency systems, but then the question is, how do they communicate with each other? We have multiple community currency systems, and it doesn't work for large things. It doesn't work for governments. It doesn't work for big corporations. So you're still going to have the big corporations driving you into the ground and not creating jobs, all those things.
Back to the topic of Greece. Did Greece have a public bank at one point?
You mean before the euro?
Yeah, before the euro.
I don't actually know. I'm afraid I'm going to have to get off the phone. It's really great talking to you, but I see that those movers of whom I mentioned are trying to call.
Aha.
Okay.
Well, it's great talking to you, Ellen, and I hope we can do this again soon. We've sort of only scratched the surface. It's great talking to you again.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Ellen.
Great talking to you too. Thank you. Bye.
Hope your mother's okay.
Oh, thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Good talking to you, Robert.